welcome to the Stranger Times podcast. I'm author CK/Queeve McDonald, but enough about me. How are you? Now, while obviously I do care deeply, deeply about the answer to that question, this is a podcast, so... But if you'd like some time to talk about yourself, just pause it for a couple of minutes and, you know, go to town. Okay, you done? Right, back to me. On with the ep. This week, in an unprecedented move, we have our first returning narrator. That's right, back by popular demand comes time-jumping, TARDIS-loving, mic-dropping, laugh-erupting Renaissance man, that is Toby Hayduck. The man who should be the next Doctor Who. I mean, I don't know who's in charge of that, who we need to talk to, but if somebody does, could we sort it out? Because honestly, it feels like it's just something that has to happen. I won't run you through all of Toby's extensive CV. He actually has CDs as well, but that's not relevant. I probably should cut this bit out, but you know what? I'm going to keep it in. I'm that lazy. Toby's extensive CV, yeah, but I'm not going to run you through it because I did all that in episode 3 of series 1. Do you remember that? Simpler, happier time. Although I should mention that since then, he has become a semi-regular on Coronation Street. Ooh. Now, if you're not from the UK, how can I explain it? Coronation Street is very much like Baywatch, where people ogle the young and beautiful while eating their tea. Tea, by the way, is what you call that meal you have in the evening. And if you don't agree with that, Corey is not the show for you. Speaking of things for you, this charming man is out on February the 17th, book 2 in the Stranger Times series. Order your copy now or you'll regret it. I can't say why, but you will. Also, if you'd like a signed copy, you can go to thestrangetimes.com, click on books, then this chairman man, and if you follow the instructions, not only can you get yourself a signed insert, but also a Stranger Times limited edition Valentine's Day card. But do it fast, because you can't turn back time. Tell you what though, people in this story can turn back time. Yeah, I know, well, that's a link. I mean, that's a cracker link. I'm very pleased with that. By the way, I've started sticking in the advertising bit just near the end of the introduction now instead of the start, because I want to see if it turns more or less people off. I think the one thing less exciting than an advert is someone explaining why they put the advert where they did. I'll be honest, this intro was literally on the last line and now it's lost all momentum. So I'm going to have to try and give it some energy. By the way, seeing as we have lost all momentum, if you're hearing any weird noises throughout this recording, Diller, my dog, is behind me in his bed in the corner of my office, vigorously licking something. I don't know what. I haven't turned around to check. I respect his privacy, but that's what he's doing. But you know, this is his office as well as mine, apparently. Anyway, probably should take all of that out. But if only there was some way to turn back time. Boom, we're back on schedule. Well, turns out people in this story can... I've done that bit, turn back. It's a time travel story. I think that's fairly clear. It's called Everybody Kills Hitler. I mean, that's fairly obvious in itself. Anyway, without further ado, please welcome the next Doctor Who, if there's any justice in the world. And let's be clear, there isn't. But if there was, please welcome reading Everybody Kills Hitler, Toby Hayduck. Diller, stop licking it. It'll fall off.
A sullen silence hung in the air as four men named John pointedly didn't look at each other. This was trickier to achieve than it sounds, as they each sat behind desks at the sides of a 20-foot by 20-foot enclosure that was open to the glowering sky. A foot-thick, padded yellow crash mat sat on the ground in the centre of the space. As they each stared at a different corner of the enclosure, huddled in their winter coats, their cold breath fogged in the air like bulls threatening to charge. All four men being called John was a coincidence that they had laughed about in lighter moments. The German was actually a Hans and the Frenchman a Jean, but still, they were four soldiers who shared a name, if not a great deal else. The American, at 23, was the junior member of the quartet, although he did not view himself in that light. The German and Englishman were of a similar age, both in their late 30s. The Frenchman was 41, and looked it, but for reasons not even truly known to himself, he'd lied and said he was 36. Perhaps in a matter of international security as this was, he felt deep down that no information should be given cheaply. The German drummed his fingers on his desk, but stopped quickly when he noticed the Frenchman glaring at him. This was all indirectly Hans's fault, although he had meant well. Day after day, the four men had sat in this enclosure between the hours of 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. It could be dull, tedious and depressing work. Some days it would come in wave upon wave, other days almost nothing. On Friday, in an effort to be a good host, Hans had brought in some of his wife's strudel, which had been greatly appreciated by the others, all the more so given the current rationing situation. Hans was a kind-hearted man, but from a young age he'd found it difficult to make friends. He was cursed with never being entirely sure whether someone was joking or not, and this made him a terrible audience for a story, forever looking for someone else's reactions to mirror for fear of causing offence. A few years ago, by accident, he'd stumbled upon the bridge-building powers of his blessed wife's cooking, a discovery that had served him well. It was, in fact, the reason he had pulled this favourable duty. It may be dull work, but it was sitting down work, and that was a position to be cherished in any man's army. The week after the strudel, the Frenchman had brought in some pain au chocolat. A tradition had now been established and a gauntlet thrown down. The following Friday, the Englishman had furnished his fellow Johns with clotted cream scones and a small flask of scotch to give their coffee a little assistance in fending off the biting Berlin winds. Hans considered the whisky to be English John slyly slipping his thumb onto the scales, but he hadn't mentioned it, and it had certainly hit the spot. Drawn by movement, the German's eyes instinctively flicked towards the Englishman. The waspishly thin Yorkshireman's experiences in the Great War had left him with a nervous twitch of the left arm and an involuntary strangled yelp that sounded like Gren. It seemed to worsen under stressful circumstances, which meant the current sullen silence could actually only be considered one out of politeness. In his idle moments, Hans had amused himself with the unkind thought that the Englishman was constantly holding himself back from pointing and loudly proclaiming where Grenoble was. He felt guilty for this. Of the trio, he'd felt the strongest kinship with the John from Yorkshire. Over those scones, they'd discovered they'd both fought on the same field at the Somme 12 years ago. The young American had reacted to this revelation as if expecting it might be a source of tension, hiding his disappointment badly when it wasn't. That was the ignorance of youth, of one who had never seen the workings of the great bloody machine up close. The enemy had never been in the other trenches. No pacifist could match the disregard for the military high command that the career soldier held. With great effort, the German did not look at his French counterpart. His plump features gave him a rather bovine quality, especially when he chewed his lunch in the irritatingly vulgar, open-mouthed manner he had. The lazy eye, which Hans could only assume was a birth defect, gave Jean an unfair advantage in the current circumstance. Even though he was staring resolutely at the opposite corner, you couldn't shake the feeling he was also looking at you. It had been the Frenchman's explosion earlier that had sucked all of the air out of this room that was not a room. The German did not dislike the American John. He'd hinted that he'd like to be referred to as Big John, but nobody had taken him up on the offer. In this situation, all Johns had to be equal as a matter of national pride. His shaggy blonde hair hung just above the piercing blue eyes that sparkled when he rolled out one of his stories, liberally sprinkled with untruth. He didn't seem to realise that those present had now heard many of his tales several times, although they were never the same twice, each new rendition having picked up another verse in the retelling. Hans supposed he was just trying to impress the older men, and his lies were at least entertainingly told. In an otherwise empty space, open to the harsh elements, the ability to fill time was not a skill to be underestimated, especially to Hans, who was so lacking in that area. If nothing else, listening to him had greatly improved Hans's English. All week, the American had been talking up the doughnuts. He had found a Berlin baker who could speak English, and so American John spent what little free time he'd had instructing him in the art of making the perfect American-style doughnut. He certainly could sell it. Each night the other men had gone home salivating at the thought of the treat awaiting them at the end of their week. Then Friday morning had rolled around without the much-anticipated doughnuts making an appearance. The American had made profuse apologies and promises about the supply issues that he was determined to resolve. If he'd have left it there, maybe everything would have been fine. Later that morning, He'd made a crack about French women and the Gallic temper had exploded. It turned out that the Frenchman, billeted in the same guesthouse for the duration of his stay in Berlin, had seen the American sneaking across the road the night before to pay a visit to the widowed landlady of the alehouse opposite. In his hands had been a baker's cardboard box. The floodgates had opened. The Great War, the current crisis, hundreds of years of world history and weeks of pet peeves and minor irritations had been weaponized and brought to bear in a four-way war without winners. Now nobody was talking to anybody else. It says something for the level of tension that they were each secretly relieved when the familiar feeling of electricity in the air made the hairs on the back of their necks stand on end. They each drew their sidearm, as per procedure, and held them pointing upwards at the ready. With his free left hand, Hans calmly took a form from the pile beside him and picked up his pen. Then a hole opened up in the sky above them, and a man from the future fell through. He landed on the padded mat with a girlish yelp and looked around him in wide-eyed disbelief. The four men looked back with what could be described as, at best, mild interest. He was predictably mid-40s, overweight, and wearing the black linen suit so many of them had. Many of them were older, a few younger, and although rarer still, some were even women. All in all, though, this one was pretty much the typical. His skin had a dark complexion that implied he was used to seeing considerably more sun than any of those present, and it had an unnervingly smooth look to it. At least this one had come through wearing clothes. Many had not. Hans had a sneaking suspicion that this was nothing to do with the technology, as they had been told, but a cruel joke played by someone at the other end. Hans cleared his throat and rolled into the agreed-upon script.
Bleiben Sie ruhig. Wir schreiben das Jahr 1928, in dem Sie nicht in Gefahr sind. Aus welchem Land kommen Sie hier?
The man from the future gave him a look of terrified incomprehension that the Quartet of Johns were all too familiar with. Hans had long ago stopped being surprised how many of their guests spoke not a word of German. Some had landed and occasionally proclaimed themselves a jelly donut, which had lightened the mood, although today of all days, that was to be avoided. Others embarrassed themselves by attempting to speak English with what they believed to be a German accent, as if that would do. To Hans, the future seemed to be a paradise built by geniuses and populated by idiots. The others looked at the man nobody referred to as Big John, who rolled his eyes and softly swore under his breath before trotting out the speech in English.
Remain calm. Year is 1928. You're not in danger. What country'd you come from?
The man from the future gawped at the man nobody called Big John, who took this as a signal to speak slightly more loudly.
Remain calm. The year is...
The Futurian, as many had taken to calling them, interrupted.
You're American?
After a while in this job, you couldn't help but develop an ear for accents. There was a clicking sound as in near-perfect synchronicity. Jean, Hans and Yorkshire John put their pens down and leaned back in their chairs, still keeping their revolvers trained on the visitor. Not Big John grumpily started to fill out a form.
Where in the United States are you from, sir?
The man from the future continued to stare around him.
Where am I?
Just outside Berlin. Now where are you from?
Why have you all got guns?
Just stay calm and you won't need to find out. Answer the question, sir. Where are you from?
California.
Not Big John shook his head. Figures. Not Big John then proceeded to read out the long statement, full of clauses and legal language, where the US government acknowledged the new arrival's claim of US citizenship and promised to process it when possible. This was part of the process Hans considered utterly pointless. Every time, the Futurian stared blankly around them, not taking anything in, wearing a facial expression akin to a dog who had just been shown a card trick. Not all of the Futurians were American, of course, far from it. There'd been numerous Germans, British, French, people from almost every country in the world, some of which didn't even exist. There'd been a lot from a place called Israel, that had proven particularly tricky in the beginning.
Where am I?
Not Big John rolled his eyes. Berlin, 1928. Remember, sir, we've covered this. What's your name? The man from a country called Tonga, who arrived a few weeks ago, had been an unexpected variation from the norm. His English had been very poor, and his German non-existent. Luckily, he had understood the universal language of four revolvers being pointed at him, and he had seemed surprisingly cheerful given the circumstances. Occasionally, some new arrivals attempted to fight their way out. Thankfully, the warning shot in the air generally calmed them down, although Jean had been forced to shoot a Japanese man in the leg 2 months ago. Nobody felt comfortable shooting an unarmed man, but orders were very clear on this. The paperwork had been most tiresome.
I demand to speak to President Hoover.
It was a curiosity that almost every American requested this. This man at least knew the name of the man he wanted to speak to. So many didn't. It seemed to be an ingrained belief within them that their leader would have nothing better to do than talk to them. It was a wonder the man got anything done.
Sure. Who can I tell him is calling? My name is John Geraldo.
The man looked slightly disconcerted. He wasn't to know why all of the other men smiled briefly before remembering they were mad at each other.
I have vital information about the future of mankind.
It was a dislikable trait of Not Big John's that he would occasionally seek to have fun at a new arrival's expense.
Golly gosh, mister, you should have said.
He picked up an invisible phone and pretended to dial it, before holding the invisible receiver to his lips.
Mr. President, this is Big John Gordon over here in Berlin. There's a Mr. Geraldo here from the future. He wants you to know there's a mean old guy called Hitler that's going to try and take over the world, and it'd be just peachy if you could stop him.
The future John understood he was being mocked, and it just made him more irritated.
Wait, how did you know? Is this some kind of joke?
He made to move towards Not Big John's desk, but paused at the sound of three safeties being taken off.
All right, that's enough.
The Englishman's deeper voice carried a calmer tone of natural authority. Not Big John flashed annoyance as his audience turned to face the Englishman.
Relax, Mr. Geraldo, was it?
He nodded.
The year is 1928. You were just outside of Berlin at a League of Nations facility. The man you know as Hitler is not alive. In fact, he never has been.
This was true. Scientists had speculated as to why this was when so many people came back looking for him. No record could be found beyond the year 1827 of anyone with that family name. One theory was that someone had found a way to go further back in time, chopping down the Hitler family tree much nearer the root. Another, that such a man had never existed. Many patriotic Germans, when faced with the horrific version of future events presented by Futurians, chose to believe that they had all been fed a fiction. Hans wanted to believe that, and yet he had been in the Great War. In his experience, circumstance could make a monster of any man.
Similarly, there is no organization known as the Nazis or the Third Reich.
The new arrival looked around the room as the four men behind the desks nodded at him in turn. Jean did so while picking his teeth distractedly with his pen. He really did have such appalling habits.
In which case, my work here is done.
Normally, a prisoner making a sudden move for an object stuck into the back of their trousers would stand a very high probability of getting shot. Luckily for him, the men with the guns had all seen this manoeuvre before. Future John snatched the grenade-sized device from his belt, held it above his head, and dramatically pressed the button. Nothing happened. He opened one eye and glanced around briefly, to confirm to himself that indeed nothing had happened. He closed his eyes again and pressed the button a few more times. They waited patiently. The first few times he'd watched this pantomime, Hans had to admit it had been amusing, but it had long since passed that point, now becoming only a depressing monument to mankind's naivety. Of course, nobody wanted a one-way trip, however heroic they considered their mission to be. That's why they'd all been given the return button. It did make some sense. If they could invent the technology to send you back through time, why wouldn't they return you forward again afterwards? They gave him a few more moments of hopeless button pressing before Not Big John cleared his throat and resumed with his questions. After that point, the subjects almost always became more compliant, once the reality of where they were had begun to sink in. He was from the year 2067, and like the others, he'd been approached by the friend of a friend of a friend who had just made an incredible discovery. How would he like to change the world? Not for the first time, Hans thought how much he'd like to get hold of the charlatans at the other end. They tried burying capsules with messages begging future generations to ban the technology, but to no effect. Apparently, this told a lot of very clever people a lot of very important things about how time worked. Once processed, Hans offered to escort the new arrival to Section 4. He enjoyed getting out of his seat when possible, especially today. They would soon be back to the same sullen silence, broken only by the Yorkshireman involuntary grinning and the Frenchman picking at his teeth. Back in his own time, the latest arrival had been something called a brand cohesion manager, putting him into the 97% of Futurians who had no appreciable skills. For scientifically advanced people, they seemed almost willfully ignorant of how any of their technologies worked. Clearly, somebody must know, but those people never seemed to get sent back. The man walked in front of Hans as Jean opened the door of Enclosure 23. Hans nodded a cursory greeting to the two guards stationed outside. Occasionally, somebody would try and make a run for it, but most quickly realised the futility of such a measure. The man had many questions, and Hans answered what he could as he led him past the concrete buildings of the supply depot. When they turned the corner, the conversation stopped. The elevated ground they were on offered a relatively expansive view of the camps as they stretched out before them. As far as the eye could see, men in raggedy clothing looked out from behind barbed wire at the time to which they did not belong. The new arrival looked back at Hans in disbelief. Hans hated this moment.
There are 34 such holes as the one you came through in Germany, another 17 in France, and 24 or so more scattered across Europe. Each one averages 83 new arrivals in each 24-hour period, and you started coming through 8 years ago. That's the best part of 1.5 million men a year. But I didn't. You didn't travel back as far as some. Many came from 2 centuries after you did. Each of you, I'm afraid, believing that they too were the first. You have arrived in the midst of a global economic crisis, ever since the great crash of 1921. He looked panicked now.
But the crash happens in 1929.
Yes, so the first of you told us. Men falling from the sky, telling us the sky is about to fall. It caused a great panic.
I'm an American citizen, and the German government 100% supports your claim. Sadly, the American government does not.
Hans pointed towards the various sections as they stretched out into the distance before them.
Such claims are also not acknowledged by the governments of Britain, China, Russia, Japan. You are all men out of place and time. 20 million and counting.
The new arrival looked numb. The Section 4 guards saluted as they came to take him away. They would burn his clothes and delouse him to prevent the spread of disease. Then, to aid with the administrative nightmare that the ever-growing camps had become, the League of Nation guards inside would issue him with a number, tattooed on his arm. Hans trudged back towards Enclosure 23, pulling his coat tight around him as the chill wind caught it. As he passed through the door, the hair on the back of his neck stood up. He reclaimed his seat and once again drew his revolver as a man from the future fell from the sky.
Thank you for listening to the Stranger Times podcast. If you've enjoyed it, then please leave a rating wherever you get your pods. It really does help. And the Stranger Times novel by C.K. MacDonald is out and is available from all good bookshops and some bad ones.
And check out strangertimes.com for more weird news and to sign up to the newsletter, where you can also get yourself a sweet free ebook containing some Stranger Times short stories. This podcast is produced by Rob B at BEE, with Ed Wilson exec producing, and all materials are copyright McFlurry Inc. Limited. All of the short stories are written by me, CK McDonald, and the music is done by Alan McGuire, with John McCullough as musical Sven Gally.